welcome to Reimagining the Internet from the Initiative for Digital Public Infrastructure at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. We're talking to researchers, techies, activists, academics, and journalists about what's wrong with the internet and how to fix it. I'm your host, Ethan Zuckerman. Those of you who were here yesterday heard some ideas about how we might build a very different type of internet, one that's focused on tools and services that aren't just there to make money, but are there to help us be better citizens and better neighbors. So that's an internet that's run by volunteers. It's built on people's interests and passions. And there's a lot of problems that might be solved by that model, but one of the problems that probably is not solved by that model is mis- and disinformation. If we actually want to combat mis- and disinformation, we need to understand much better how information moves and flows, how people come to believe things that aren't true, and how we might help people understand what's real, but how we might also understand where people are coming from when they share things that we think aren't real. So we have two astounding contributors to this conversation, and I really couldn't be more thrilled about it. We have someone who I've just become a huge fan of, Barbara Pfister. She is Professor Emerita in Library at Gustavus Adolphus College. She describes herself as a professional curmudgeon, although a very good-hearted one. She's a blogger, a big thinker about information literacy, and she's written really one of the best essays written in this last year or two about conspiracy theories, QAnon, information literacy, called Lizard People in the Library. It's really about the limits and the power of media literacy in working with mis- and disinformation. But right now, Barbara, I want to hand the stage over to you and hear a little bit more about how this helps us think through conspiracy theories and QAnon and whether or not media literacy is our way through this. So please welcome to the stage, Barbara Pfister.
Thank you. I want to show what Francesca just said to everybody in school, because it was just fascinating, especially when it comes to things like understanding how Google actually works and why whatever it is they're doing with as engineers doesn't defeat the fact that we're in these different places using different language. And that's just great stuff. It's so important to think about that with search, which seems so neutral. So I wanted to start by saying that I'm coming to you from southern Minnesota. I'm on land that was taken from the Dakota people of the Ossetee Sacoan by a fraudulent treaty a long time ago. And so I need to acknowledge that my home is on stolen land and that I grew up with kind of a misunderstanding of the people who came here, were here long before my ancestors came over from Europe and who are still here. And I'm trying to unlearn the things that I learned as a child. I mean, I grew up with the Little House on the Prairie books and with the typical myth of the America, the romance, the American frontier, which is a kind of a colonialist mindset that I'm trying to unlearn. So this kind of spooky picture is titled American Progress. And it shows this woman, this gigantic woman striding across the land. She's wearing a sort of a classical toga outfit. Looks like she might have a wardrobe malfunction at any minute, but here she goes, bringing light and technology with her as she strides across the land. The native people and the wildlife are all being pushed off to the west into darkness as she brightens the land. And she's actually carrying telegraph wire, and she's stringing telegraph wire across the country and bringing other technologies of farming and mining and the railroads with her. This is a colonialist version of the American progress. It was reprinted in a lot of travel guidebooks to encourage people to go out and settle this vast and supposedly empty land out there. I think this is a mindset that we haven't unlearned sufficiently, and it still infuses a lot of how the internet has developed in the United States and then been exported around the world. We tend to think of this as a very individualistic place where anybody can be anything they want to be, and they can build new businesses and be entrepreneurs, and everything is wonderful. You see this in some of the early language around the internet, John Perry Barlow's famous Declaration of the Independence of Cyberspace made this argument that on the internet, there's no such thing as privilege or prejudice. We're all equals and we're all able to express our beliefs. We can be who we want to be. And somehow, magically, out of enlightened self-interest, some new form of governance is going to emerge that will be free of the tyranny of the old world. You see that too in like the Facebook slogan, to give people the power to share and make the world more open and connected, as if that's a really easy thing to do. As Ethan remarked yesterday, Facebook, or Mark Zuckerberg at least, likes to talk about the Facebook community. Well, you cannot have a community of 3 billion people in countries right around the world. Instead, what we have is a very different kind of a motivation for building things on the internet. And Adrienne LaFrance of The Atlantic used a word that I think is really accurate in an article that she published about Facebook last year. She said it's really imperialistic. And I think that's exactly right. So I'm a practicing librarian, and for the past 30 plus years, I've been trying to help students understand how information works in a variety of ways. Currently, I'm affiliated with Project Information Literacy, which is a nonprofit research institute based in Northern California and directed by Dr. Allison Head. And she has shepherded into existence a dozen really in-depth studies about, not about how we teach information literacy, but students' experiences with information, both how they use it for school purposes, how they experience information in their daily life, how they deal with the news, and how do they process that? And then even what happens to them after they graduate from their undergraduate university career. Over these years, it's involved 22,000 students learning at 92 different institutions in the United States. Before this, I joined Project Information Literacy in 2019. Before that, I was just a major fan of the project and eagerly awaited each new report. But I was able to join just in time to work on a report we called Information Literacy in the Age of Algorithms, to kind of get at how do students understand the world of information as it is now, being so influenced by algorithms and AI and machine learning? What do they know about it? What do they think about it? And now I'm a contributing editor to this new series of essays. I was able to write the first one, this Lizard People in the Library essay, but we're trying to have people come in and say something that might provoke interesting conversations about what we should do with information literacy. When I look back at my time as a working librarian, I was at a small liberal arts college library for over 30 years. And when I look back, I think about how the claims we made for promoting information and media literacy were often framed in terms of anxiety about new technologies. So in the 80s, when I started, it was all about, oh my God, the information age is coming and it's going to change everything. And if we don't really work at it, people will be left behind. Entire nations may be left behind. As the web came along and we began to try to grapple with the fact that there was a platform people could use to express themselves in all kinds of ways, it was another kind of anxiety. I noticed a lot of faculty who just assumed students would figure out how to find and use information suddenly wanted to bring their classes into the library to talk about this thing, this web where anybody could publish. It was a fear of having a world without gatekeepers. And frequently in the 90s, librarians would point students to websites that were full of fraudulent, kind of exuberantly fraudulent information, and we would point and laugh and say, see, you can't trust that stuff. One of them became quite famous, but it was created by a professor at a state university down the road from me, who wrote this, it's a very 90s website, pointing to things like, come visit Mankato, Minnesota. It never snows here. We have bales in the river. We have this massive underwater city you can go visit. It was just obvious nonsense. A few people believed in it, and the New York Times reported on this, actually, like, oh yeah, Chamber of Commerce is annoyed that people are coming here looking for whales. But the story in the Times was the story we were telling in the classroom to a large extent. On the web, skepticism is a required navigational aid. On the web, anything is possible and nothing is necessarily true. More recently, of course, it's the fake news crisis that got us all up in arms and trying to make, we tended to make a lot of guides to learning how to test for facts and decide which things were true or not. So very often we're kind of picking up on some new anxiety and trying to solve it somehow with media and information literacy in the classroom by tweaking what we do. It doesn't really get at the bigger picture, though, because what we're trying to do, both in K-12 media literacy and at the university level, is develop this really complex set of skills, knowledges, practices, and dispositions so that students can do more than just find and use information, but so that they can see themselves as part of how we interpret and make sense of the world around us, and also to see the systems and how they act on the world. We want students to do some complicated things, understand how media and information systems work, and enjoy research, get into it, feel passionate about it, feel part of a collective effort addressing questions that matter, and basically to develop what we in Project Information Literacy started to call information agency, seeing yourself as someone who has the right and has the ability to create new knowledge, to question authority, to be able to make up our own minds. In practice, it doesn't totally work out that way, because in the classroom, very often, students are positioned as naive information consumers who just simply need to be trained to be better at shopping for information. So in the K-12 system, that may be media literacy lessons that help them critically examine media objects and reject ones that are faulty somehow. At the university level, very often it's a matter of helping students focus on what information is available for them in these walled gardens of university libraries so that they can become better able to pick out information for their projects. It may be 5 to 10 peer-reviewed articles that they can use that will be safe. And then we don't necessarily talk about the bigger information picture when they're really focused on doing these tests that will satisfy their professors. So again, kind of being positioned as consumers shopping for information. As Google and Amazon began to make it seem like research should be really convenient, fast, and easy, libraries felt compelled to try to design their sites very much like Google. And so we have now, you know, library websites where there's a single search box and you can type in a topic like neoliberalism. And instantly you get over 100,000 results, you know, what from the everything library. Isn't that wonderful? You have so much consumer choice. Fabulous. Well, that doesn't really help you understand neoliberalism, and it doesn't really help you navigate to what might be really good essential sources on that topic. So it's no wonder that students come up with workarounds for that. Over the years, as Project Information Literacy has done this research, we find students have trouble getting started on their research projects, partly because they're thrown into doing research on topics they know very little about, so they have to kind of scope out the whole landscape of that question. And very often, honestly, they don't really care about those questions. They're trying to discover something about a topic that's been assigned to them or a group of topics they can pick from. They tend to adopt a strategy early on and they stick to it, sometimes going back to the same databases over and over again, looking for sources that will be not necessarily informative, but will be safe, ones that their professors approve of. They're very avid news consumers. They really follow the news, but they don't trust it. They a third of the students in a really large study of how college students consume news said that they don't trust any news at all, which is slightly less than I think the general American population, which also has a high level of distrust of the news. The one that still blows my mind was when they talked to students who were a few years out of from their undergraduate education and in the workplace. and were asked about their use of information and how it related to what they learned at school. And the vast majority of students in the survey said they didn't think college prepared them to ask questions of their own, which, you know, just stabbed me in the heart. This is what liberal education is supposed to do. That was very dispiriting. And when we talked to them about the current world of algorithms, full of algorithms, we learned that they feel both highly indignant. They really hate the way their privacy is invaded. But they also feel resignation. They don't think they can do anything about it. It's just the tools they have to use, and they have no influence over them. We also heard some very discouraging things about what they've been learning in school. Remember, we have that really big goals for education in media and information literacy, and yet what we were hearing was, oh, yeah, that stuff. Well, my instructors tell us to use the databases in the library. That's how we learn how to handle information. These are databases you will be kicked out of as soon as you graduate. You won't have access to them, but that's what we're supposed to use. One student said they talk a lot in school about .org or .edu. I remember hearing that advice 20 years ago, and it was terrible advice back then, but apparently it's still coming up in classrooms. Or the student who said, oh yeah, that two-day thing where they help us, you know, tell us how to find quality sources. Well, I've heard that in high school, and it doesn't really work because it's not the way it used to be, which is true. We also heard them say that they felt like they were in a very different place than their professors. They said the professors, one student said, they come from a pre-social media age, and they're used to being able to trust different resources that they've always gone to. And when we interviewed their professors, we actually found them saying the same kind of thing. Oh, these are the sources I go to for my news, for my information. Whereas we grew up with untrustworthy sources, and it drilled into us, you need to do the research because it can't be trusted. So I find it really fascinating that Francesca's hearing that from people who are much older and yet are also believing this idea that we each individually have to go out and make sense of things for ourselves. And of course, some of this is shaped by being shown silly websites about whales in the Minnesota River. We can't trust anything. We have to do the research. And yet, even though I'm hearing these dispiriting things from students, a lot of people think the solution to our disinformation problem is more media literacy. Like this tweet from, I think, last week where somebody said, with some luck, tomorrow's kids will be taught these skills in school. Like, what have I been doing for 30 years? Well, that's disappointing. I don't think more of the same is necessarily going to help at all, because it turns out that people who believe things that are making us so upset about the idea of misinformation are actually, by these qualifications, quite media literate. They understand how these systems work. They're very good at working these systems, in fact. They're really deeply into interpreting media messages critically. They feel the passion for discovery we wish our students felt. They feel part of a collective effort to address these big questions that matter, because this is a life and death struggle between good and evil for them. So it's really, they feel very purposeful in this research, and they enjoy it. And they have information agency in spades. This is a meme that was circulating around QAnon circles. And you can see in this that they're saying the same things. Research for yourself. Use logic. Think critically. Think for yourself. All that independent ways of delving into things. But it's also showing there's this kind of alternate authority structure being built, so that you should trust yourself, but also trust your president, trust the plan, fight for truth. So what do we do with this? And sometimes I just don't know. I just feel like I have no answers. I don't know how we're going to overcome these really deep-seated epistemological differences. If we can't agree on how we know what is true, then I don't know how we're ever going to find common ground. So sometimes, I don't know, I just despair. But since I've been in classrooms and I want some kind of practical advice for people who are trying to do this sort of teaching and learning, I have to come up with some ideas. So one is, I think we need to reemphasize the importance of learning to trust, not just how to be skeptical, but rather trust is really important. But we need to get at why to trust rather than what to trust. Too often we do shortcuts like go find peer-reviewed research. That's trustworthy. Well, no, it's not. And that doesn't really solve the problem. So we need to unpack the underlying values of the knowledge systems, institutions, and practices so that we have some idea of why a well-respected newspaper might have practices underlying it and values of the journalist that the journalists hold that might make it worth trusting. And the same for science, for scholarship, for all kinds of ways of knowing. I think we need to talk more about how information systems work on society. And in talking to faculty about this, I got a sense that, you know, like, I'm really worried about this and I have no idea how to bring this into my classroom because I just don't know enough about it. So to that, I say, look for the helpers. There's bound to be people on your campus or in your school who know a lot more than you might realize. And if we can put those people in conversation together, we might be able to solve some of these problems. Plus, there's fabulous research being done and really worth reading. There's educational materials being developed that go way beyond look for .edu, for heaven's sakes. So there's stuff out there that I think can help us make these shifts. Peer-to-peer learning, I think, is really important. When we talk to students in focus groups, they were so interested in learning from each other. Sometimes it kind of called things to a halt. A student would talk about what they do to protect their privacy online, and another student would say, hold it, wait a minute, let me write that down. What was that VPN again? So they were learning from each other, and they didn't expect to learn from their teachers. They knew that they're used to learning from each other. And there's a lot of knowledge out there among the students, which when combined with what they're learning in their classes, I think could be really powerful and would give them a chance to learn by teaching each other. I think they also could do some interesting learning through community outreach. The students we talked to were deeply concerned about their grandparents, about their elders, and they were also worried about their younger siblings. What was happening to them because they were growing up in a world where social media is ubiquitous. So I think they really felt empowered and interested in helping other age groups and other kinds of people understand information. I think we need to encourage information agency, not just consumerism, but no, you are here. You are part of this information ecosystem. You have a role to play, but also pair that with a sense of responsibility. Help people think about what is my code of ethics when it comes to sharing information. And finally, frame learning about information systems as education for democracy. We have a tendency to think, well, this stuff is political, so we can't really deal with it. Or it's political, so we're just going to say that's a Republican belief. This is a Democratic Party belief. Apologies to those who are coming from another country. This is very American-centric of me. But we do tend to kind of divide things up in terms of politics, when I think really we could be talking about how does this kind of information system bolster or harm democracy? And let me just also kind of pull back to the bigger question of how do we reimagine the internet? What can we do? Well, there's one way of thinking about developing these communities around information that I think has some interesting potential as a model. And it's been around for over 100 years. And it's the public library. If we had to invent them today, people couldn't even imagine it, or they would imagine it could not be done. I mean, it just would be impossible. And yet very nearly every American community has a public library or public library system. Most Americans have access in some way to a public library system, even if they don't have broadband, less access to broadband than to libraries. They're certainly not perfect. There's a lot of stuff needing to be worked out. And yet, what libraries do, I think, could inform our thinking about what the internet could be. They provide equitable access with a local community focus. And I think I want to just basically focus on that one thing, because this is a community that is bounded by an almost kind of arbitrary geographic boundary, a taxation group. But within that boundary, there are people of all different kinds. And in the library, everybody is equally belongs to that library, can use that library, feels like the library is there. So it doesn't matter what age you are, what gender you are, what your political identity is. You can go to the library for a lot of different reasons, and it still works. And it's one place where you can go in and you will be next to a homeless person, and you will be next to somebody who's very well healed, somebody who's coming here for the latest genre fiction, somebody who's coming here to get help with applying for a job online or doing some deep genealogical research. People belong to the library for different reasons, and they share that space with people who are different from them. They aren't there because they're the same. They're not there because they're united by an ideology or an interest or a set of grievances and anger at somebody else. And within that, the library has to negotiate a lot of things about how do we balance different needs? How do we respect different perspectives? How do we deal with it when people are upset about one thing or another within that space? And yet there's been a lot of practice doing that over the years. So I think that's at least one example of how we could think about and maybe learn something from the experience of public libraries. Because I think fundamentally another internet is possible, and we just need to use our imaginations for that. Thanks.
Reimagining the Internet is hosted by me, Ethan Zuckerman, and produced by Mike Sugarman, who also composed this music. Follow us at publicinfrastructure.org to learn more about what we're up to at the Initiative for Digital Public Infrastructure, and please subscribe to this podcast wherever you're listening to it.